What are the conditions of experience? That's criticism. That's it in its fucking barest, most basic form. What are the conditions of experience, of knowledge, really, right?
We are live.
Okay.
Okay. Dear listener, you are listening to the Pill Pod, the only non-anime podcast on the internet. You will not hear us reference anime. Do anyone watch it, anime?
No.
I did look up that face that people make sometimes. Like, you know what I'm talking about. No one's going to see this.
But I mean the giant eyes and the tiny mouth?
They stick their tongue out and go cross-eyed. That has a name. I looked it up. I can't remember it, but...
Drops of sweat fly off their head.
I think it's manga. I think it's porno, but I'm interested.
Is manga the porn?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Is it only porn? I don't think manga is always pornographic.
You know that face they make, though, when like...
like they're tired?
It's like a dog tired, but cross-eyed.
I don't know. My brother told me to watch this one that has a giant robot. No, the kid's brother dies, and then he turns him into a robot. Or something. Just couldn't
Full Metal Alchemist. Yeah.
Oh, is that it?
That's the one.
I believe it's good. It's just not my thing. No anime on this podcast.
Only anime so far.
Long story short.
Ending now.
Okay.
So you are going to hang out with us and dose yourself on critical theory, philosophy, and every other genre but anime. It's a spinoff of the Plastic Pills YouTube channel to which I upload videos. But this, really, the purpose of it is hanging out with my friends. But then we get to do more long form analysis of the sorts of issues that I like to take on in there. So we're going to be drawing from texts, maybe watching movies, maybe talking about current events, depending on the day. So we are a bunch of doctoral students or former doctoral students, midwives of the soul. Anyway, we're kicking back with some books, beers, and student debt. So our one and only caveat is that although we're all experts in something, none of us are experts in everything, even though we'll never admit to that. You'll hear some political philosophy, psychoanalysis, cultural analysis, and other bullshit untold as we hold hands to witness the decline of, you know,
everything.
So today we are going to try to justify why we're doing a critical theory podcast. But we read an article by a man named Bruno Latour called "Why Has Critique Run Out of Steam?" So why don't we do some intros? We're all guys of something, and it's a little bit bro-y today. That won't always be the case, but. It's not by design. It's just by circumstance. Yeah,
it's not our fault. Girls don't want to hang out with us.
Yeah, we're all biologically male. There are females in the building.
That's true.
But they didn't want a podcast with us.
So forgive us for being bro-y. It's what you get when you got bros, I guess. Yeah. And once I figure out the technology of remote people, then we can resolve that quite quickly. But
who better to talk about dead white men than living white men, as far as I'm concerned?
Amen.
Not all white.
Son of a bitch.
So critical theory. Why don't we talk about what that is, or our definition? We are already arguing about this. So,
yeah.
Or just resuming an argument we were having before we started.
Well, it seems like, Eric, you want to include in critical theory many different things that maybe Plastic Pills and I would want to limit more to a more political philosophy realm.
Yeah, I would say it starts with Frankfurt School.
Yeah.
Neo-Marxism.
Well, the Oxford Dictionary defines theory as... it's... critical theory starts with Kant, right? A lot of what we're going to be talking about begins with Kant, the critique of pure reason, critique of practical reason.
I'm just saying just because he wrote things with critique in the title doesn't make it critical theory in the way that people bring up the term.
with a capital K. No, excuse like, me. Everyone talks about critical theory and in the humanities, and it's all originating with Kant, right? If you go like if you look at who's the most referenced person in the humanities literature, it's Foucault. And what does Foucault say? He says, you know, whatever intellectual road you can go down, there's probably Kant or Hegel already at the end of it. Kant really started critique and Hegel ended it.
Right. So it seems like you are calling critical theory a form of doing philosophy. And before Kant, would you say that what was being done, how was it different? And what, like, so what John Locke was doing or what Descartes was doing, is that different than
Hume?
Well, I would say
saying that science is actually philosophy because it used to be called natural philosophy.
Well, if we're going to get this basic, yeah. Yeah, like John Locke says, no, John Locke is not a critical theorist because he says we're a fucking tabula rasa when we're born, right? But Kant believes that we do have structures of the mind that do structure the world that we experience, right? Some of the basic things are time and space and numbers and those kinds of relationships, right, that emerge from numbers like cause and effect. So Kant is clearly not a tabula rasa believer. He thinks that we do. And in many ways, Descartes is as well, right? Descartes believes that we do have innate ideas. We don't, we don't learn these things. We have them, we're born with them. And the only difference is like, you know, whether they're handed down to us by God or they're evolutionarily developed, maybe. That's the major difference between someone post-Darwin.
And Victor, what do we think critical theory is?
I guess for me, I always think of critical theory as just starting with the Frankfurt School, a certain mode of Marxist analysis of society and politics. But like that's just when I hear critical theory, and if I see on, you know, a faculty webpage and there's like a professor and they list in their interest critical theory, in my mind, that's like Frankfurt School. But I mean, there might just be two different senses in which it would be correct to use the term critical theory.
Well, there's probably many, but we can at least say that, especially with the Frankfurt School, that starting with Marx, I mean, we now know that we believe in ideology without knowing why. And so I think, you know, the very first starting point you have to have when you have critical theory is showing why we're believing in ideologies without knowing why, unmasking that unknown element. And this is where Freud comes in. Why do we enjoy these discourses?
That's psychoanalysis guy, by the way, Alex. So in addition to psychoanalysis, what are the other schools we're talking about? Neo-Marxism, structuralism, post-structuralism.
And feminism, which will definitely overlap feminism. Psychoanalysis.
But I wonder if the sense in which Kant... So do you think Kant was doing something similar, like undermining, revealing something like that our intuitions were wrong, like doing that kind of critical exercise, just like showing that we live according to some ideology or some, it's not ideology in his case, but I guess it's like structures of understanding or something like that.
Well, it evolved into what ideology is, right? Kant talks about critique as in like a transcendental criticism of what you would call a priori knowledge, right? The subject, the human being, the human, the mind.
And subtly religious knowledge. He's taking on opinion, supposition, belief.
Sure. Critique, according to Kant, would be like figuring out the forms of a priori knowledge, a priori meaning before experience, right? So what kinds of forms of knowledge is the subject bringing to the world? And I mentioned earlier, a couple of those are space and time. Like, what are the conditions of experience, for example? We need to have these things in place already in the mind. So transcendence refers to what is before experience in the subject. That's critique.
Right. Okay.
And that really goes back, I mean, everyone, we're always going to say this when we're in the humanities, but it goes back to Aristotle and Plato. Mm-hmm. And those sorts of figures, right? Like,
well, if you're trying to find out first causes, then everything is critical theory.
Right, exactly. So, that's kind of maybe.
So I'm narrowing it for at least what is it? Five schools: feminism, neo-Marxism, structuralism, whatever Derrida is.
Yeah.
The language critique realm, and then I guess you got people like Virilio and Baudrillard who take this cultural studies kind of approach. I think I would call that critical. Ideology critique, I think, is a good definition.
Well, we're definitely going to be adding in some critical race studies and post-colonialism, too.
Yeah, I forgot that. I'm a white man.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, colonialism. Yeah, but they are thinking about the conditions of experience, the pre-experiential, the a priori conditions of experience, right? For Kant, there's the a priori synthetic knowledge.
All right. So those are the things that we're going to be talking about.
Like, what I would want to tell everyone before we begin discussing critical theory, and we're going to read an article that is anti-theory. But what I want to talk about before we read this article is to say that, yeah, Latour was involved in the science wars. And the science wars was... I mean, I'm repeating myself, but for this, the science wars was about demonstrating the extent to which scientific facts about the world, objectivity, are actually socially constructed. And Bruno Latour is now going to say in this article, why has critique run out of steam? Like the extent to which he regrets pushing that argument so far, right? To say that facts are socially constructed.
All right, why don't we relate this back to our mentor, Jordan Peterson? Can we put this in the same family as that? If so, why? If so, why not? Because Jordan Peterson is he's made a career off saying, you know, facts, we don't need to do all this theory, all this being sus about everything. And he says, why don't we just talk about the facts and name what is as it is. So this article is from 2003, delivered it, and then 2004 it was published, which is kind of worlds away, at least in my mind, in terms of the political environment and all that.
Pretty goddamn prophetic.
It's very prophetic.
Yeah, I found it extremely relevant in terms of what he was saying already, probably exacerbated by internet communication. But
what are some of the main reasons that Latour thinks his mode of critique has gone too far?
Well, one
what
of
was
them,
going on back in 2000?
Well, one of them is the rise of a kind of ecological consciousness, right? Like the rise of environmentalism. Hmm. Like we went from saying that, like, what's an example of something Latour talked about? Like something banal, like Louis Pasteur and the pasteurization of France, right? Like, he's going to talk about the way that it's not just the discovery of pasteurization that was important and how to pasteurize, like, milk and cheese. The important part is the social development of that fact, which is all the laboratories and all the farms and all the distribution networks around France then began to mimic Louis Pasteur's laboratory. And that was the condition of the spread of that so-called fact, was the social organization and not the discovery of the fact itself that made it real, right? Like, you can go outside and you can discover whatever fucking fact you want. You can go run into a wall, for instance. You can go outside and run full force into a brick wall and say, I have discovered a fact that this hurts. But if nobody else mimics that discovery and sets up a distribution network to deliver that information to other people and to measure what happens when that happens, then that fact bears nothing on reality. That fact is, like, you can't even call it real.
So just to backtrack a little bit, we're talking about the split between what is real in terms of facts, what he's calling, and then
matters of fact,
and then social constructivism on the other hand. So he's saying basically, I guess we'll get into it, but it's Bruno,
matters of concern.
Bruno Latour, Why is critique run out of steam from matters of fact to matters of concern? And the thing at issue, which is still something similar to what you hear often these days, is we're dealing too much with these abstract concepts, and intellectuals are just far too up there, are way too up. They're far too far up their own ass, and they make everything into political issues or issues of ideology, and never, or basically to the point of denying that facts are real.
We go to grad school so we could be right all the time, not so that we could change anything.
Well, yeah, I think one of the distinctions Latour makes that's interesting in the article is that, like, one of the tendencies that critique has is to always be examining the conditions for something to appear the way that it does, rather than like the thing, right? So, you know, you look at, well, how the assumption, it almost seems like in critique, is you're suspicious of the appearance of things, and then instead you look underneath and you're trying to find the conditions that make that appearance possible. So if you're looking at, I think at least this is my understanding of what he was saying, and that critique is always trying to uncover, well, what are the conditions that allowed that thing to appear that way? Would you agree with that, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. That's the conditions of experience of reality.
So, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of what was, you know, some of the examples he brought up. Well, I guess, he works in science studies, right? So for him, I guess it's like the way facts, what are the conditions that allowed for the facts about climate change to appear the way that they do, rather than some investigation maybe in the appearance of them themselves, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, just for some context, like what he basically says, or he was involved in the science war. So this is a reflection upon his own role in that. And it sounds at some points like regretful because this socially constructed sense of facts is now being used by, you know, Republicans to deny climate change. That's one of his most telling examples. And again, he wrote this, what, 17 years ago or so.
Maybe we could go over what the science wars are, because in some detail, because I don't actually think I know.
Oh, I'd have to let Eric talk about that. But no, what I wanted to bring up is we hear this, like, you know, the Neil deGrasse Tyson type, who are like, facts are facts, this is science, we're doing work, you're not doing work. So Latour was actually on the other side of that, saying, you know, facts are not always just facts, how they appear, context matters, and things like that. But now he's swapping halfway to saying, you know what, we need to take facts seriously and we should be critiquing matters of concern, basically, or using them as methods of critique.
Well, he says that we should be not fighting empiricism, but renewing it. And he says that we should be, if I'm correct, cultivating a stubbornly realist attitude, he says. He says, though, but a realism dealing with what I will call matters of concern, not matters of fact. This is when he brings up Columbia, C-SPAN 1 and C-SPAN 2, Columbia the shuttle, and waging a war on Iraq. He says, Columbia was an omen not heeded. Basically, what he's saying is, why would you be waging a war across halfway across the world when you can't even get your shuttle to space? But yeah, this idea of fact versus matters of concern, I think this is one of the central issues of his argument. What do you guys think about this differentiation? What does it mean?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a bit of, I'm not actually 100% sure that I'm able in my head to reconstruct this distinction between matters of fact and matters of concern. Maybe one of you can do that.
So Latour is going to, like, this is an early article, right? When we read Reassembling the Social, he's going to lay out his entire theory, like actor network theory, ANT, right? And one of the chapters is going to be from matters of fact to matters of concern. And matters of fact is basically what you would think of as basic scientific objectivity, right? We all have problems with that idea of, like, scientific facts are simply objective. And then on the other side, we also have problems with saying, like, when scientists do their work and they try to, like, whatever, convey to us scientific facts about the world, objective facts about the world, we're all going to say, well, you're coming from a certain perspective and you are also a subject and you have your biases. So nothing really is purely objective. And we're going to have this argument and it's going to last for all eternity. And what Bruno Latour wants to say is like, well, let's just stop talking about matters of fact. Start talking about matters of concern. And this is where the reference to Heidegger comes in later in the article, right? Like matters of fact are really things, right? And how does Heidegger define a thing? Well, he defines a thing as something that gets a bunch of people together.
Right.
Right? A thing, right? We all get together in whatever, the Icelandic owl thing. That's their political parliament system, the all thing. And we discuss it and we try to not establish a fact, but we try to settle a matter of concern, right? We're all concerned about something, whatever. We're all concerned about pasteurization or other big facts about STS, Michael Callan studying clam fishing, for instance. We're all worried about how clams turn out after we switch from fishing with fishing lines to inserting these like scientific devices into the water and really just harvesting them that way. Those are matters of concern, right?
So, yeah, he almost uses the words assembly and thing with a capital T interchangeably. He says things, lowercase t, have become things, capital T, again. Objects have re-entered the arena.
Das Ding. That's a reference to The Gathering in Heidegger, I think.
Yeah.
Basically being coalesces into the space that you've cleared through or cleared for it, and language is not disconnected from that process. Language is a part of that gathering up of a thing such that it can become objectified.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they do say
that would be later Heidegger after his Nazi exile.
Mm. However, this article would be good to read alongside Heidegger's The Thing.
Yeah, we should do Heidegger again.
But not again. Heidegger is The Thing. One of the things he says about The Thing is that the thing is a gathering, right? The thing is a political structure. Old Germanic societies where people would get together and discuss some matter that affects a bunch of people. Like that's why even colloquially we say like, oh, that's a thing. Oh,
yeah.
Something's a thing.
That's important to us. One right. Affects our life.
Well, yeah. He goes in on Heidegger for talking about, he says, a philosopher spends so much time drinking coffee and like sitting in desks that they keep bringing up desks and cups and jugs as examples, sometimes rocks as examples of things. But we have these things also that are much more complex. Like, is it fine to say that a car is a tool and a rock is the same type of thing as that? When they have these, what does he call them? Folds, infinite folds.
The fourfold.
Christ. No, he said the fourfold's way too simple. He wants infinity.
Yeah.
In a Deleuzian moment.
There's only four.
So how would like an understanding or an emphasizing matters of concern as opposed to matters of facts change like the way Latour would want us to think about things like climate change or that we would normally, because like I guess climate change is a matter of concern, obviously, and then the facts are playing some role. In that as a, or it's just like a rethinking. I'm just curious how.
No, he wants to move from debates over matters of fact to debates about matters of concern. So we shouldn't be addressing the object in that way of, is it true or not? It should be, I guess, more dialogic or discursive in creating it as a matter of concern. I don't know. I haven't read Reassembling the Social for, I noticed I have notes on it, but I don't remember reading it at all. So, do you want to turn to that maybe more? What is giving this agency sort of thing to the object, which he does through Whitehead in here? But I want to kind of get the philosophy out of the way because I would rather talk about the application and why we should be doing a podcast on critical theory if critiques run out of steam.
Yeah, well, one of the major parts of critical theory is that you're going to encounter this hard divide between humans and non-humans, right? So when Kant brings up critical theory, right, he's clearly thinking of human beings. What are the transcendental conditions of experience, right? That's in the human mind. And when Bruno Latour brings up matters of concern, like there's a background of criticism of Kantian critique, you could say. There's a background of Latour rejecting the Kantian notion and also what he would call the asymmetrical definition of the social, which basically means that social existence is defined by two basic spheres, you could say. One sphere is the human sphere. That's the subject sphere. The sphere where mind and thinking and human beings and rationality fit in. And the object sphere, the sphere where all the things that we use and all the things that we take for granted, the material world, in some cases, animals. He wants to take that, what is called the asymmetrical definition of the social, where you have humans on the one side and you have basically everything else on the other side. And he wants to take that and make a symmetrical definition of the social, where you have equal parts on both sides, you could say. Although in the symmetrical side, there would not be two sides because it would be a hybrid. However, on the one side with the subject, there would not be simply human beings. And on the side of the object, there would not be simply non-human things. Because that's an asymmetrical definition of the social. And you can think, what does asymmetrical mean in this case? Well, okay, there's human beings, and then there's the rest of the universe. That's pretty fucking asymmetrical, right? that's human beings represent a pretty small part of the entire universe. But we have, by our philosophy, going back, again, remember, this is critique. This is an anti-critical theory philosophy. Going back to Kant, that's how we've defined things. We've defined things based on the subject is the human mind and the object is everything fucking else. So what Latour...
Well, Kant tried to overcome that. It was more Descartes that introduced that divide with that rigidity.
Well, you'd say... In this tradition, you'd say, yes, Descartes introduced the mind-body divide, but... The mind-body divide is a little bit different from what Kant introduced, which was the subject-object divide. And the subject is the subject of like an idea or a thought, and the object is what is represented or what is intended in that thought. So Kant sort of initiated this subject-object divide, like because they're not quite so concerned with Descartes. They're more concerned with Kant in this case, but they want to present a symmetrical definition of the social, which involves, you know, not putting humans on one side and everything else on the other side. And he has these, sorry, if I can continue, he has these amusing examples of this in his books. For example, like if you're a historian describing a war, you wouldn't put human beings, let's say a bunch of naked soldiers on one side and all of their equipment and their clothing and their tanks and everything on the other side, and then proceed to relate them dialectically to one another, right? You wouldn't start out that way. You would sort of start in the middle where humans have clothes on and humans have objects and they're hybrid social beings. They're not subjects and objects already together. That's how Latour gives an example.
Okay. So this relates obviously to the, you know, humanism versus post-humanism tendency, where really a lot of these guys and systems theories included in this, like Niklas Luhmann, for example, they're trying to get, and Whitehead, they're trying to get to these generalized definitions of agency that aren't particular to human. And that was actually very popular, I think, in the early 2000s.
And this is why it's anti-critique, because critique generally draws a distinction between the human and the everything else. And the everything else becomes the object, and the human becomes the social.
Right.
And some of the figures you were bringing up, Luhmann, Whitehead, they don't have that. They don't have that in their philosophies.
Yeah, so we're being very highfalutin theoretical right now, which is fine, but I think we could turn to some of the examples that he used in the text to kind of look at the things that he was going after in the first half of the article.
Yeah.
So he says, entire PhD programs are still running to make sure that good American kids are learning the hard way that facts are made up, that there's no such thing as natural, unmediated, unbiased access to truth, that we are all prisoners of language, that we always speak from a particular standpoint, and so on.
Well, I was kind of hoping maybe we could build on what Eric was just saying and like kind of as a bridge to this. Actually, I think I'm looking at the same page as you. I'm wondering, like, this critique you're talking about, like, how does that relate exactly? I think it'd be nice to just like kind of connect it to the article. So like, how is that form of critique connected to what Latour is complaining about as a mode of critique, which is like always undermining, you know, our intuitions about the world. So like Latour is basically talking about something that we could relate to, you know, the master of suspicion, like Marx, Freud, and Nietzsche, who like want to undermine like things like truth and want to undermine the fact that maybe like capitalism is really just an ideology, and Freud, who wants to undermine our own like feeling like we're transparent to ourselves. You know, Freud would be like, we're not transparent to ourselves. There's all these things that are actually controlling us. So sort of like suspicious of our kind of everyday experience of the world and say that there are like these underlying forces. And in some ways, it seemed to me that Latour was critiquing this constant tendency to be suspicious of our own intuitions about the world. And I'm just wondering how that connects to the account you were giving. Like, maybe we could just bridge that like higher philosophical account to what Latour is complaining about.
Because if you've been to grad school, you know exactly what he's saying is correct.
Yeah, exactly. Like, for sure. It's definitely very compelling. Whoa,
what are we trying to undermine today?
Exactly. So I'm just wondering if like how that fits into the different, like the sort of, what do you call them? Symmetrical or
yes. Symmetrical definition of the social.
Right. So how would that, I'm curious, like would these modes of critique that he's complaining about fit, which of those would it fit under?
When you're a sociologist, you're going to be starting out with someone like Durkheim.
Yeah.
He's the same kind of figure, right? He has a subject-object divide, except for him, it's the social, right? And the social really only includes human beings. And that's why it's asymmetrical, because it includes human beings, and outside of the social is everything else.
And okay.
That's why it's asymmetrical.
Okay, I get it. Yeah.
And a symmetrical definition of the social would really include non-humans, right? We associate with non-human things, right? And it's silly. Like Latour gives these silly examples, like try changing the channel without a remote control, right? Or try talking to your friends without, like, I guess a modern example, without cell phones. Like, those would be silly examples, but really those things are what support the social, right? Our cell phones and our networks and our internet and our infrastructure support the social. And if we really go on studying the world with this asymmetrical definition where the social really only includes humans and thinking and subjectivity, and everything else is the object, and that's for someone else to study.
Wait a second, but is that what these theories are doing?
I think we're confusing two things, because disassembling the social is not particularly his discounting of critical theory in this way.
Well, that's what I was, because I was wondering if there was like a connection. I was trying to kind of.
Well, the reason he goes to Whitehead basically says that atoms are social things. Right. Sociability goes all the way down, or societies go all the way down.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Sociality does not exclude everything except for human sociality, right?
Yeah, but that's not what he's saying in the first half of the article. Yeah.
Right. So I was trying to, I wasn't sure.
So there isn't actually connection. Though that's more of a gripe that he has.
Okay, so that's later. I thought maybe there was some way of making a connection there.
Okay, let's try and clarify a little bit of what he's doing early on, like when you brought up that quote about what PhD programs are doing.
Yeah.
You know, that we always speak from a particular standpoint, that we're prisoners of language. If we take this too far, I think, you know, he's talking about us wavering between two major poles that we should not be wavering between, that we've been doing a long time as critics. So what he's saying is that, you know, we are pointing out to people that everything that they think are facts are also social constructs. All these facts are loaded with desire and unconscious drives.
Sounds good to me.
And so if we're constantly saying this and calling every fact into question, then that's a problem. He says that in that same paragraph, we're calling everything into question. Basically, we always speak from a particular standpoint. And he says, and so on, while dangerous extremists are using the very same argument of social construction to destroy hard-won evidence that could save our lives. So to look a little bit further, he says we should do a little bit of soul searching as critics.
He wrote this before anti-vaxxers were.
Yeah, I know. It's very, very prophetic.
So he says the critic is, this is his hope, that the critic will not be the one who alternates haphazardly between anti-fetishism and positivism. So the one who says everything is loaded with desire, and the fact that you're a prisoner of your desire and your language and your unconscious, that's saying to someone, hey, what you believe in, that's just a fetish. He says at some point in his article how condescending and how it's pretty much one of the worst evils to tell someone that what they believe is a fetish.
Yeah, I like that.
And he's saying, but we're wavering between that and positive, which is positivism, just strict, strictly paying attention only to facts. Not questioning ourselves at all, perhaps, would be my way of putting it. And so I think we could say that he's looking at matters of fact kind of as ideology and, you know, saying anti-fetishism is a way to critique ideology, but we go too far. And so he's saying we need to try to, you know, reconnect. You know, this is where assembly comes in. We need to take these matters of fact, turn them into objects around which we assemble. He says the critic is not one who debunks, but the one who assembles. The critic is not the one who lifts the rug from under the feet. By that, I mean critique ideology of the naive believers, but the one who offers the participants arenas in which to gather. So what he's giving us here is these two poles and saying they're both wrong. We don't just critique ideology as critics. We create new arenas, create matters of concern around facts.
Right.
He's a lib.
But I'm wondering, you know, it might be interesting to think of examples of like I'd be curious. I mean, I'm sure we all, as graduate students or former graduate students, like know exactly what he's talking about with this tendency to always be wanting to critique everything. And I feel like, yeah, it's quite prophetic from 2003. I mean, some things that came to mind where, you know, there's a lot of, and maybe this doesn't quite fit with what he's complaining about, but I know, like, maybe because I happen to be grading a class where this comes up all the time, like, you know, that category of positionality, right? That, like, everything is, you know, your positionality, which seems true, but I wonder, I don't know, maybe that doesn't really connect to this, but it does seem.
Yeah, it does.
Like, somewhat that it's like, you know, we're always sort of, like, we have to be suspicious of, like, any of our perceptions because it's all being contaminated, I guess, by our positionality, you know, and another figure that came to my mind was, Alexander Dugin. Do you guys know who that is? He's like this Russian political theorist. He's kind of like the state political theorist for Russia and the Putin government. And he came to mind, especially in the part of the passage that he wrote where, you know, he's saying forces are using like these methods of critique against us, because one of the biggest things that Dugin draws on to sort of defend the like right of Russian, of what he calls Eurasianism, to maintain its own like cultures is to use, he borrows from Claude Lévi-Strauss, the like, you know, anthropologist, to say that everything is socially constructed, to like say we have to respect these cultures. And it's like, we as Russians, the fact that maybe we want to say no to gay marriage. We want to say no to this. It's like, you Western colonialists are trying to force this on us, Russians, right? So it's like he's using this mode of critique to say, and in fact, what he calls for is this like new global pluralism where, you know, we have to respect each other's cultures and you have to respect us, Russia, here, and we respect you, and stop with your Western imperialism of like trying to tell us that, you know, that homosexuality is something we should accept, for example. And this is recent. You guys should look him up. He's an interesting figure, this Dugin, who's having quite a big influence.
You sometimes hear the same thing with respect to like Saudi governments,
yeah,
that are taking all this money, but then you say, hey, women can't drive in your country. Stop being imperialist.
Yeah, exactly.
When they're fighting wars with Canadian LAVs.
I was thinking that what Latour was not apologizing for, but maybe turning on in this essay was saying.
That's one thing. Sorry to interrupt you, but that's one thing I found interesting is he never says I was wrong. It's more, did we go too far? So yeah. Is in his mind, like, we shouldn't have given these tools to the plebs? He calls himself a patrician at one point.
Yeah.
Wow. Is it like we shouldn't have shown the plebs how to do this?
Yeah.
Or because he never says I'm wrong to do this, right?
Or he's saying our tools are now being used against us. And he's saying that specifically in terms of like, okay, global warming is a scientific fact, so let's not say otherwise. But what he was saying before is that what we're dealing with is, okay, like when he's involved in the science wars in the 80s or something like that, he's saying that, oh, scientific facts aren't objective. They're really just socially constructive. They're ideologies. But now what we're looking at is, well, now what we have to defend is that, well, scientific facts are objective and they're not just disguised ideologies, right? Like global warming is not like a left-wing concern. It's an objective fact. And yet he's saying, why does it sting my tongue to say that global warming is a fact and you can't deny it? Because he spent so much of his career saying that scientific facts are socially constructed. And now he's trying to think through this idea that scientific facts are, yes, okay, they're socially constructed, but now how do we articulate in this era of ecological catastrophe that, well, maybe scientific facts actually are these objective things and they're not really just bad ideologies. They're not just left-wing or socialist concerns. They're actually something out there happening in the world.
Yeah.
Well, you can't blame the early Latour for not predicting that people would be dumb enough to deny climate change.
Yeah. Well, he's blaming himself. Latour is blaming early Latour for laying the groundwork for conspiracy theory and for climate denial.
No, he wanted to get published, so he had to.
Well, actually, it's funny. Yeah, you mentioned that he called himself a patrician before. Actually, I think I found like the passage here on
somewhere near the end, right?
On 230, on page 230, he says, "You know what's happening to me? You may wonder.
Yeah.
Is this a case of midlife crisis? No, alas, I passed middle age quite a long time ago." Is this a patrician spite for the popularization of critique, as if critique should be reserved for the elite and remain difficult and strenuous like mountain climbing or yachting, and is no longer worth the trouble if everyone can do it?
Dude, he's a great writer.
Yeah, right? He's like, what would be so bad with critique for the people? We have been complaining so much about the gullible masses swallowing naturalized facts. It would be really unfair to now discredit the same masses for their, what should I call it, gullible criticism? Quite interesting.
This is like what Twitter is, right?
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's everyone can be the critic. I don't like, depending on the cause, that's good or bad, but everybody knows like the word patriarchy now. It's not an arcane academic term.
Or positionality.
Unlike capital, ideas really do trickle down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or today I learned something objective about the world.
And it gets into our culture too, without having to say it directly. Like, look at all the feminist films that, you know, you look at them after and say, hey, that actually had a feminist message.
Cool. Think of the frustration we have today about like all the blockades on the train line. We're saying, okay, they need to blockade in Canada here. They need to stop natural gas pipelines from passing through their territories because objectively that's bad for the environment. But the opposed people say, nah, that's just a socialist ideology and those things should be built and the Canadian government should just send in the army and remove those people. We say, no, it's an objective fact that climate change is bad and they should defend against anything that's going to, you know, violate that.
I have a question. If he wants to move on from this matters of fact to a matter of concern kind of thing, then how can you trust that our enemies on climate change are going to make that move with us? Because they want to probably stay in matters of fact such that they can say, you know, you can't prove objectively that that's true. That's your opinion. That's a politicized issue that you're bringing up. But if you say, oh, we're going to take the higher ground and now become matters of concern people, how do you know that your opponents are going to want to take that move while they're winning or while they're serving their own interests?
Well, you don't, because matters of concern are settled. They're agreed upon. Matters of fact are invoked. Matters of concern are talked about and discussed and disagreed upon. Matters of fact are just things you try to talk about to end a conversation.
So when we were, or in 2003, I mean, I don't know because I was barely conscious at that point, but it sounds to me like it was not polarized.
Definitely not to the extent.
Like it is.
There was quite a bit of polarization over the Iraq war and stuff, which was about to happen. So maybe yeah, at the time of writing, though,
he started in February 2003, right?
Right.
So if there's this degree of, you know, the politicization of facts, I guess my question is about the politics here. Like, is it something that you can make someone else move past? Or is he just talking to an academic audience?
Yeah, I mean,
because it doesn't sound like it's an academic audience, particularly if you're talking about climate change denial or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm still not totally clear on how you can like shift to just being about like, or maybe it's like an emphasis of matters of concern, because it seems like matters of concern seems so influenced by matters of fact. Like it's like facts, it seems like, or at least what we would intuitively call facts, seem to inform what counts as a matter of concern or something like that, right? It's like if it turns out that something is not a matter of fact, then it's like, how can it be a matter of concern if it doesn't even exist or something, right? I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm wondering what's the move to like to something that we can operationalize in like let's say like the language of like supporting or opposing a policy proposal or something.
And remember, he's talking about matter of concern in terms of assembly, which
and science studies.
Yeah. It's weird. Why is he using it in terms of the thing? For Kant, the thing was unknowable. For Freud, the thing was that unknowable part of yourself. Is there any sort of parallel here? I'm a little bit worried that matters of concern could just turn into endless talking and no doing. Does anyone share my worry?
Well, that's like, I was kind of thinking that too. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's kind of the point.
People are just going to make podcasts and nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, think of it. He's into science studies, right? So matters of concern for him are things like, well, you can look at what he's historically been interested in, like pasteurization or like whatever STS has been involved in generally, you know, fishing for clams.
Is that what STS has been up to?
Yeah, yeah. They've been up to that sort of thing.
Fishing for clams.
Yeah, yeah. Or you could look at it and say, okay, like a matter of concern for science has been things like the Big Bang theory or evolution. Like those are never like, what do you want? You want those things to be just like set down and solved. In 2025, the Big Bang Theory was settled. And in 2032, evolution was, everything was determined about it. We don't need to talk about it anymore. Like that sounds equally stupid, does it not? Like we sorted out, okay, didn't like.
Well, it seems like you need both.
Darwin came up with it and we worked it out. And 250 years later, we now understand evolution. And we don't need to ever talk about it again. It's a matter of fact now. Evolution, right? It's a matter of fact. Doesn't yeah. that sounds really silly to me.
Doesn't it seem like you need both though?
What about the Copernican revolution? When you say that just became fact, it was a matter of concern.
Yeah, a paradigm shift. Like that's a really good point, actually. I don't know. You stump me because you say, okay, well, the Earth is no longer the center of the universe in our cultural world. Now the sun is the center of, well, the galaxy anyway, not the universe. And so, well, that's where we're moving forward from now. So is that
until recently?
But
flat Earth. Who knew that would come out again? Anyway,
but also you think like Galileo also said, okay, well, that solves a bunch of problems, but we still have a load of other problems. Like for instance, Galileo couldn't give up perfectly circular orbits. It took someone else to come along and say, well, maybe orbits are oblong shaped. Matters of concern are settled by discourse and debate in the public sphere. Matters of fact are just asserted like fascist people who just come up and say, that's true and fuck you if you don't believe me, right? But matters of concern are a genuinely democratic way of talking about the real world.
So then I guess the question would be, does global warming, like we're going to maybe die, go extinct from this?
Yeah.
Should we keep it as a matter of concern? Like this is open to debate, I guess would be my
political question. The door is going in that direction. Global warming is a fact. So we all need to get out there and kill all the conservatives because it's a fucking fact, right? So let's get out there and let's kill. Let's kill the conservative.
This is parody.
Maybe, parody. Or it's a matter of parody. Concern.
Okay, we've come to a point where we've talked about the assembly. I want to raise this again. Like, will the assembly just be endless talking? And he does try to give us some solutions in the end. Not entirely sure I understood them, but this is where Whitehead comes in. He says he wants to give criticism a whole new set of positive metaphors, gestures, attitudes, habits and thoughts, and so on. So
here's just before you go, like,
well, actually I was going to turn to you here. This is what brings up Whitehead.
About Whitehead. Yeah. I've read quite a bit of Whitehead, but I thought this was the worst time to bring up Whitehead because now you want something actually political as a goal. Now that you've assembled your people, what are you actually going to do? And then he brings up Whitehead, who's basically talking about the feelings between monads. But what were you going to ask?
Okay, so he's saying here the problem is the bifurcation of nature, if I remember correctly. You guys remember that phrase?
Yeah.
Yes.
So he brings up Whitehead and tells us we need a new form of critique. He brings up, calls us machines, I think. You guys remember what that part was about?
The bifurcation of nature.
Computers here and Turing and what it is to be a programmer.
Culture, nature.
Can we just talk about, since we brought up flat earthers, conspiracy theories? Because he says, and we should probably answer this if we're going to podcast. He basically says that, not their equivalent, but that critical theory has the same structure as a conspiracy theory, which is there's this secret thing going on that is controlling people's behavior. So we could call this capitalism. You can call it the patriarchy.
The unconscious.
You can call it... Would that have the same...
The way he's using it, yeah.
Okay, so the unconscious. So depending on the critical method that you're adopting, we have these concepts that are kind of controlling everything. So for neo-Marxism, it's capitalism. For feminism, it's the patriarchy. And he's saying that critical theory has the same structure as a conspiracy theory as trying to look through the appearances that everyone else is deceived by. Like everyone else is in the cave and theorists just get off on themselves saying like, we're outside the cave because we can see everything that's happening.
But again, the difference.
This to me was my least favorite part of the article because I wouldn't call it in those simple terms. He shits on Baudrillard for a second too, which I guess I took a little bit personally.
Yeah, Baudrillard deserves to be shit on.
Now, Baudrillard writes in The Spirit of Terrorism, I think. I don't know. Baudrillard basically says that
work it out.
The collapse of the Twin Towers was a symbolic event and talks about how.
Yeah, it wasn't real.
You know, they both had to fall together because
it never happened. It was
the perfect symmetry. No, the Gulf War didn't happen. 9/11. But the symmetry of the two towers falling was necessary.
Nobody died. Nobody died. It never happened.
So, yeah, he gets concerned about this. And this is probably, I mean, I'm not going to take a hard stance either way on this article, but no, this is where no, I would say, no, I think that matters of social construction are more interesting and just as worth talking about. Because you can talk about the World Trade Center in terms of my methodology systems theory. You could call it an economic event. You could call it a cultural event. You could call it a media event. You could call it just gravity happening, right? There's so many ways to articulate this depending on what you make your matters of concern there. So Baudrillard, obviously being Baudrillard, wants to talk about this as just, you know, a symbol of American domination.
Yeah, as a Saussurean semiological event.
It was
just,
it was like an image event for us. It was, yeah, we needed to see it happen sort of thing.
Something that we all experienced, but didn't. But wasn't real.
It was part of the signifying complex. So it was a sign that had to
occur. It was real insofar as we all saw.
If we're talking about Latour in this, this is where I'd actually just go in on this, being like, what you're talking about sounds boring. And I know it's not a good critique of philosophy to just say it's boring, unless you're, I don't know, Deleuze. But I kind of want that image twisting, saying things that you wouldn't expect, keeping you on your toes kind of thinking, not necessarily this gathering, like let's all gather around and discuss this thing. Yeah. And then we'll have a better sense.
A little bit utopian.
It feels boring, right?
There's a lot of
conspiracy theories surrounding the 9/11 thing, right?
Too, they're fun. Conspiracy theories are fun.
Okay, can I say that? I'm going to say that to you. I love conspiracy theories.
They're fun.
Like, yeah.
Like the Mandela effect. I kind of buy into the 9/11 ones a little bit. I'm not totally denying them.
I just mean the Mandela effect, for example, is like my memory of a Berenstain Bears book can't be wrong. So actually reality must have changed course at some time between my childhood and now. We're in a different universe. What? I mean... We shouldn't only be judging theory based on whether it's interesting or not.
I agree this gathering thing, though. I was kind of going to bring up because I was like trying to figure out, because I'm still kind of caught up on this like matters of concern, matters of fact. And on 232, in like the second paragraph, you know, he starts talking about matters of fact as being really good for debunking, which is basically what you're... So it's funny because it seems like he's making an association here with matters of fact, which were, as he says, excellent for debunking quite a lot of beliefs, powers, and illusions. It found itself totally disarmed once matters of fact in turn were eaten up by the same debunking impetus, right? So it's like the debunking impetus is, I guess, this form of critical undermining. So it's like, I guess I'm still trying to clarify in my own head, like this movement from like matters of fact, which were good. We use science to debunk beliefs we had, but then we came up with this other critical, which I think he's trying to say still sort of uses the same structure, which is like to undermine things. And then that's when he talks about how
he's saying critical theory uses the same arguments that he was using earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
To discredit scientific facts.
But then he tries to talk about this ambiguous thing, which you call boring, right? Which I kind of agree with you. Plastic pills.
I'm a persona.
You're a persona, yes.
You know, hyper-real? I'm a gathering of personae.
Yeah, that we can devise another powerful descriptive tool that deals this time with matters of concern whose import then will no longer be to debunk, but to protect and to care, as Donna Haraway would put it. So that seems like weird and ambiguous. It's like
it's kind of cool too, though.
If we kind of think like conspiracy theories, I mean, the internet kind of proffers those, right? I mean, the sense of conspiracy that you get, I would call it like a psychological reaction. The fact that there is a conspiracy in terms of what Adorno would call the culture industry, for example, it's not like people are sitting here doing this consciously, but it's an effect of a system in the culture industry case of monopoly media ownership. It's not really a conspiracy theory, right? Because it's kind of happening.
Sure, sure. So there's something he's getting at here. And I think he's getting past a stage of critique. And I'm wondering, are we just going to have to constantly get past new stages of critique? He mentions, you know, how you can't just constantly say, oh, we're all prisoners of language, you know, enslaved by our unconscious and all this stuff. We got to start thinking about facts as an assembly. He has this one interesting moment where, I mean, I think basically he's saying this is what we're all doing to each other. We're shutting each other down, not having any dialogue, basically because of this reason. He says, this is why you can be at once and without even sensing any contradiction, one, an anti-fetishist for everything you don't believe in, for the most part, religion, popular culture, art, politics, and so on. Two, an unrepentant positivist for all the sciences you believe in, sociology, economics, conspiracy theory, genetics, evolutionary psychology, semiotics, just pick your preferred field of study. And three, a perfectly healthy, sturdy realist for what you really cherish. And of course, it might be criticism itself, but also painting, bird watching, Shakespeare, baboons, proteins, and so on. So he's saying we have all these contradictions within ourselves. And, you know, they inform the way we react to other people with different cherished beliefs, different antagonisms. And so he wants us to get past of all of this stuff. Stop calling each other fetishists. Stop being, you know, such hardline positivists. Become realists in some sort of sense. But yeah, so let's say we get to this moment of assembly where the thing is what matters and matters of concern are the thing. We all stop being so rug lifting on each other and share concerns and stuff. But don't you guys think that's also going to require telling each other to stop, you know, being such prisoners to our desires and discourse and social constructs all over again? And we're constantly have to say, hey, you need to alter your position because you're enjoying your ego too much and what you're getting out of being against certain positions and validating others.
This is precisely the back and forth he's going to point out in this article.
How do we get past it? Do you think he does?
No, he does not.
I don't think that discourse gets us to be friends with Ben Shapiro and I don't know, whatever those other
I think he's pointing it out as like a project for us to move past. Right?
That's what I was asking before. Is he talking to academics? Is he talking about people in the science war or is he talking about people in the culture
war? Well, no, he's talking
to everyone.
According to who the article is dedicated to, he's talking to Graham Harman, right? The object-oriented ontologist.
I think this is a rabbit trail we should not...
That's who he's talking
to. Just accept. No,
he dedicated it to him. But he says at the beginning, culture wars. We're talking about real wars.
No, he's talking about all the wars, and he was involved in the science wars. That's what he is really referencing, right? He references social text later in the article. He's talking about
So is this just two academics that he's talking about, though?
Yeah. I would say so. What's this article published in? What's the audience that this article is published in? He's talking to an intellectual audience. He's not trying to broadcast what he's saying here.
So this might not have direct relevance to what we're actually talking about.
Well,
because like
No, but we can take it and we can filter it and we can give the important points to everyone.
I was kind of thinking about that too. Like, what's the audience for it? I didn't pick up on the Graham Harmon thing. Like, I didn't notice that he dedicates it to him. Is that like right at the beginning?
It's right at the first page.
Oh, it's in a footnote.
Oh, it's in a footnote. Okay. So
this guy doesn't read footnotes.
No, I don't read footnotes.
Who does read footnotes?
A lot of people apparently do, I've been told.
Every time.
I don't read anything with foot in it.
Oh, I learned so much from footnotes. Yeah. Everybody read footnotes.
I mean, Kierkegaard's footnotes, which are like 14 pages long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I to me, it did read like not quite as an academic article. It kind of read to me as like sort of an op-ed piece to, I guess, academics, but it wasn't exactly like, it seemed, or like people who are like academic adjacent or something like that.
That's Latour's style. That's just how
how he writes. Okay.
Well, it's a polemic, but then he brings up like a Republican, he's a French academic, bring up a Republican American senator, right?
He brings up Frank Luntz and he talks about the way that Frank Luntz said, like, hey, let's say climate change instead of global warming because it's more neutral sounding
term. Well,
I guess his conclusion would make more sense if that were clear. And that's not criticizing his writing because he's obviously, he knows who his audience is. He's part of a discussion that we are not a part of in 2003. But if this is supposed to be a plan in general for, you know, how do we work together to solve climate change, then he's hoping that that's going to be, I don't know, a solution. He doesn't seem to me to be that naive,
though. It seems prophetic with the level of climate change denial that we have today. And what he's saying, if you can think of climate change denialists today, right? You go on any post on Facebook from CBC or CNN or any major news network and you look at the comments, like they're all climate change denialists, basically, who comment on those things, right? Because they have very extreme views and they can't wait to fucking share them with everyone on Facebook, right? That's exactly what Bruno Latour predicted, right? Their reality is not consisting of facts. Their reality consists of ideologies, right?
Yeah.
They consider facts to be badly disguised ideologies. That's what they consider it, right? I
mean, it's very reminiscent of what our friend Matt McManus does with his work on postmodern conservatism.
If I go out on the street right now and I tell people climate change is a problem and we need to do something about it, everyone's going to think I'm a left wingist. I'm a left wingist.
A wingist.
I'm a wingist. You're a left winger, right? It's an ideology. Like the people who don't, like, okay, so people will come up to me and say, yeah, that's great. But the people who come up to me and say, you're full of shit, they're going to think I'm a fucking Democrat or I'm a socialist or I'm something else, right? They think climate change is a socialist conspiracy, right? So that's what he's saying. It's the opposite of what he was doing before, which was saying that scientific facts are socially constructed. Now we're saying scientific facts are just really badly disguised ideologies.
So I'm going to go on a limb here. If that's the case, then ideology is not something we should move past. That's more important than ever. We just need to be more ideological and combative about it, not more like, let's incorporate all these voices into the dialogue.
We want to talk about it, apparently. And
well, that's what critical theory is critiquing ideology.
Yeah, of course. But he does talk about this a move from deconstruction to constructivism or something. It's like not.
That's a cheap. That's like a friggin' Pete Buttigieg line.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's what I didn't like about the article. I mean, what I liked about the article was the critique of criticizing, the critique of critique. I like that. I enjoyed that part of it. But then,
yeah, like if all of us are just jerking ourselves off, then what is a critique of a critique?
Yeah.
Why don't we analyze that?
Exactly. Well, I was going to go out on the next limb and say, you know, we can never get out of ideology. So simply being a cultural critic and saying, hey, there's ideology there. You're being ideological there. You don't understand your ideology there. You're speaking within an ideology yourself. So maybe we could say there are actually some good ideologies and some bad ones. Maybe critique can be a good one and a bad one, but maybe part of this thing of being an assembly.
But paradoxically,
thing is yeah. saying, hey, me critiquing you is ideological, but hey, somebody's got to do it. You can critique me too.
I think Latour
sounds like an object of concern that you're presenting to
us. I think Latour is pointing out these problems and not really offering solutions to them.
Then what's the end of his, what's the latter half of his article? Because it sounded like he was trying to gesture towards some sort of constructive project.
Well, the last
two we all days. Gather in a Viking longhouse and have a outing.
Yeah. We gather around the horn and we all the wife gives it to us and we drink out of it. Yeah, Latour is very. That's why Graham Harmon had so much trouble like reconstructing what Latour's politics would be, is because Latour is never clear about his politics. Like Latour is a Catholic. You'd never get that from reading what he writes. It's really just objective structures that determine your subjectivity, like the Marxist relation mode of production, or some other things that determine your subjectivity. And there's no winning. That's the whole point.
When he's talking about that at that section of the article, like what he basically says, this is what PhD programs are designed to do. I feel like that's a total straw man. I know the people that he's talking about, and even they don't do that.
I think when right-wingers talk about like university campuses.
But he's talking about left-wingers at this point. He's saying the critic always comes out on top, and they like that feeling.
No, he's saying this is the tool that conspiracy theorists and right-wing climate change denialists, these are the tools that they're using.
Yeah, that started with the left.
Say,
he explicitly says that the whole
thing has. It's true that this tool is being used, and it does sometimes lead to a kind of deadlock. Like even in like, you know, people who are involved in post-colonial activist circles, like in academia, like people I've come into contact with, like when you start overemphasizing a mode of critique that leads you to always be like, well, that's because of your white privilege, or that's because of this, or it's like if you lead to this kind of like comprehensive explanation, which is based on, I think, good reasons, but it's like it gets taken too far where it becomes a deadlock where you can no longer say anything in response to it, because it's like that's just explained by your positionality as a white straight male or whatever the case may be.
I mean, that's true, but that's a bastardized version of the post-colonial argument, which is not based on that. He's writing to academics, then that's one thing. I don't think academics do that nearly as much as people like Peterson.
But undergrads who misread it, then go on and they, and like, I mean, I'm watching it happen.
Is he talking to a popular audience, or is he talking to an academic audience? But he's acting like this is the specter that we need to
combat. It's happening in activist spaces and it's happening with undergrads, but maybe it's not happening with sophisticated academics.
If I come along and say, if I come along and say global warming is a thing and what needs to happen is carbon tax, right? A right winger is going to come along and say, no, that is your socialist perspective. You're projecting that onto the world.
But the whole article is entitled Why Critique Ran Out of Steam. I think the right wing is like, oh, this is a bad result. But he's been saying academics are doing this all along. We've been doing this too much.
Yeah, he said we were doing that too much. And now the tools of what academics have been doing have been smuggled across the border to more conservative people. So now that we're saying, okay, well, we don't believe in, say, like phrenology, for instance, like measuring people's heads to determine how smart they are, right? Okay, that's silly. But now you can make the exact same argument about climate change, and it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, but that is not what he's talking about in the article.
That is what he's talking about.
He talks about it one time.
That's exactly.
But the rest of it, he's attacking what we would call left-wing politics.
He talks about it one time, but that's because it's framing all of what he's talking about.
It's true, but he is attacking what we would call left-wing politics.
Yeah, all of what he's talking about is
and not just because the right-wingers got a
hold. He talks about conspiracy theories. He talks about right-wingers. He talks about the deficiencies of critique and the ways that critique are being smuggled across the border and used by right-wingers to criticize those sorts of environmentalist perspectives. And now Latour's going to write
is not that they got a hold of it. He's saying that we were wrong to push it that far in the first place.
Yeah. And now Latour is going to write books later about climate change and about he's going to write Facing Gaia. And he's going to write another version of this article in the first paper that you see in that book. And it's going to say the same thing. It's going to say the subject-object divide. It's going to say, like, it's going to say all of the same things.
I guess, I don't know. Like, to me, I read the article to be more about, that the cause of that, like, the reason it's become that way seemed to me that he was saying maybe because an academia pushed it too hard. And, like, that was the condition of possibility for these right-wingers to do that, is that you know, you're undergrads who maybe have conservative tendencies are going to universities and they're learning about this fancy mode of critique and then they're using it and then they get to, I don't know.
I wonder what the trickle-down model is, because I'm pretty sure Mitch McConnell has not read Judith Butler.
So no, he hasn't, but his staffers might have.
He very directly says, like, we're disarming, like, we're deconstructing armaments, we are demolishing them as though they were actual nukes. So yeah,
he's aware. But then he says they're using it against us as like dirty bombs or box cutters. Is that, did I read that correctly?
I think I remember something like that.
Like, we're disarming our nukes, but they're using dirty bombs against us.
Yeah, he's saying we can't just dismantle this because it's founded on like two millennia of philosophy. It's not, he says, it's not like just dismantling like a Russian bomb silo.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like you can escape the circle of critique, because like he's even critiquing critique, you know, that critique is just a lot of fun. So yeah.
That's why we're here.
And that's why I enjoyed this article. That's the paradox. He's critiquing critique in this article and talking about how it makes us feel good and how we always feel smarter because we're just revealing how the conditions of people's views are actually like influenced by all these factors. And it's like fun. And then he's doing that to the mode of critique itself. And then I'm having fun reading them. And I'm just like, yeah.
And I'll do you one better.
Yeah.
That's who can get the furthest view back.
I think he helped us out a little bit here. I mean, some of us thought he might have failed or not gone far enough or not given us enough solutions. But I found this one quote. Do you want to guess where I found it?
In a footnote?
In a footnote.
Oh, God.
Read your footnotes, kids.
So, you know, we're here. Making a podcast, not sure where it's going to go. He gives us a quote by Turing. He says in his footnote, number 37, since Turing can be taken as the first and best programmer, those who believe in defining machines by inputs and outputs should meditate his confession. Quote, machines take me by surprise with great frequency. This is largely because I do not do sufficient calculation to decide what to expect them to do, or rather because although I do a calculation, I do it in a hurried, slipshod fashion, taking risks. Perhaps I say to myself, I suppose the voltage here ought to be the same as there. Anyway, let's assume it is. Naturally, I am often wrong. And the result is a surprise for me, for by the time the experiment is done, these assumptions have been forgotten. So Turing is giving us these confessions. And I think all we can say is, you know, what is the thing other than putting in slipshod calculations, trying to have dialogue, doing podcasts, and just seeing what fun comes out of it. Might do some good.
I like that because it phrases it as an experiment. Like existence and thought is experimental.
Yeah, I like that too.
Yeah.
So did we end up being mistaken when we said that this paper maybe didn't give us enough solutions?
No.
No, I appreciate the polemic, which is kind of why I picked it.
Well, I like the polemic part, but I didn't think his constructive stuff at the end like made a whole lot of sense to me. I just didn't. It seemed like maybe fancy language for something that's just obvious or I didn't get it.
The Habermas public sphere, kind of bears relation to.
Seemed like it.
When someone receives an idea, let me say, when someone receives
an idea. Keep your mic next to your face, please.
There's two things that happen when someone receives an idea. First of all, someone receives an idea, it creates an excitation, and then
excitation.
It dies down. And The second thing that happens is someone receives an idea and it creates a whole new world. It edit this part to give it a bang.
you just wrote a long ass quote by Alan Turing.
Yeah.
But basically, it comes to the same point. What you call an excitation is what Whitehead calls an irritation. And Whitehead was used a lot by both Latour and Deleuze, which seemed to be doing something similar and saying, we need creative models, not, I guess, combative or
undermining. It's undermining. Like it seems to be always, he worries about the fact that it's always debunking
things together.
I like to actually debunk things without offering any solutions. It's my favorite thing.
That's the thing. Yeah. Debunking is
because you're a cowardly academic.
That's what we do in cultural studies. Just debunk, debunk, debunk. Don't say why. Just, you know, question your privilege, check your privilege. Don't think of solutions.
Yeah.
No, there's two things we do. We debunk, but we also construct theories.
Well, those who actually do that.
We make arguments and we debunk ideas. We
edit this part to make it awesome.
Bunk things. Let's bunk things.
We're bunking ideas.
I'm going to have to turn Eric down in post because I think he holds his mic closer to his face or something.
When he's actually holding it by his face.
Yeah. I hold it.
Hey.
It's got very animated.
I hold it.
He has to gesticulate.
I hold it somewhere else sometimes.
Keeping this all in, baby. We're keeping this all in.
We'll edit this out.
Keep it in.
Lay it into your mic. We're going to edit this whole thing to give it a bang. You know, all the.
Why are we doing this podcast?
Why are we doing this podcast?
Are we here to bunk or debunk?
We're bunking critical theory.
I'm here to bunk.
We love critical theory.
To apply. And that's why I like having you guys all here because everyone thinks about it in their own way. So it's all thing.
This is a thing.
We're actually doing the thing right now.
This is a thing.
Might be endless discussion with no change. We need to watch out for that. Can we do with this?
No, there's no need to ever finish the discussion.
I get off on your thinking.
Or, dear listener, maybe we're thinking so you don't have to.
No, it's catharsis.
Yeah. I think people have a
thought without having thought.
Most people have a silly way of looking at the world, and I'm here to tell them what a better way to see the world is.
That's what Latour has been against the whole time.
No. Latour would let me slide past his.
We're minimum wage patricians.
We are pretty much minimum wage patricians. That's true.
Okay, but let's entertain the thought that, you know, hey, we're four guys who are privileged enough to basically read books for a living.
Yeah.
Maybe the trickle-down effect thing is real here.
Yeah.
That's what we're hoping.
Who's trickling from whom to whom?
And bunking, and you know.
Yeah.
Bunking and trickling?
Bunking, trickling.
Do you think there's de-trickling?
And applying.
Guys, I apologize at the beginning for this being too bro-y, and now we're bunking and trickling.
Well, that's all we've been doing all along.
We have to take our privilege and turn it into something other people can use to improve their lives.
Share the privilege.
That seems ambitious.
You sound like a Marxist. We don't have a Marxist on the podcast.
I'd be happy if I could just amuse
some. You wrote read some Marx though.
Oh no, we're definitely gonna be talking about Marx. But if you're a Marxist out there and you know what I mean, you're wearing an anti-flag t-shirt with a leather jacket. You have a whole bunch of buttons on your backpack and you've read the Communist Manifesto and now you just tweet.
Yeah, remember there was...
You're a Marxist.
Remember there was one of the comments on the first one, there was a guy who was just like, I wish you guys were more Marxist or something.
It was
like
the best. It was like, I wish you were more Marxist or at least Hegelian. Like, what do you mean at least?
Yeah.
At least.
We're all wearing our union toques.
We've all been involved in organized labor action, but I don't think any of us are specifically Marxist.
Not by choice. I was not involved in
that.
You know
what? Most people that say they're Marxist just mean like that defines the memes that they post.
It does often seem that way.
I think it's really sad if you think Marxism is just like waiting for the next negotiation with your employer. That's not that's not a really good definition of Marxism.
It's funny. I was talking to an old professor of mine at Ryerson University, where I did a master's degree in philosophy there. And I don't know if you guys heard about it. Maybe this is like too off topic, but I'm going to say it anyway because it's interesting. Did you guys hear about what
happened? We're adding it all out anyway.
Did you guys hear about the student union or like that at Ryerson and what happened with that? That they were like embezzling funds and how
Oh yeah,
corruption. Yeah, yeah.
The corruption, like, so the student union, right?
It's yeah.
Like the RSU, like, well, Ryerson Students Union. And they were like
spending it on buying pot.
Yeah, they were spending it on like nightclubs, like thousands of dollars on bottle service and stuff like that. And then the university was like, okay, you guys have a year to do forensic audits and like come back at us. And then they like didn't do any of that. And they didn't like share the information. And the university was like, okay, we're going to cut off ties with you. So like your legitimacy is no longer recognized by the university. And then what my professor friend was saying, how it was like annoying the way his own like faculty union. And this is the thing, the issue that I sometimes have with unions, even though I'm generally supportive of like labor action, is that there's like an ideological aspect. So like, even though maybe it's like stupid that they're, but like the faculty union had to come out and be like, we condemn the university for like breaking its ties with the student union, when like the student union was obviously like acting a fool. I don't know.
Yeah, they did exactly what happened in The Irishman with the union in that film.
Except they weren't Italian. That's a big faux pas.
It's like anything, just because the university is technically management and they did something against them, but technically they're like, we have to be against this. Because
In this analogy, the university is the mafia and the union are the guys that...
The kids who are spending money on bottle service, thousands of dollars on like student fees on bottle service.
Well, that's part of the student experience. They're entitled to
that. Yeah, they're the
well, you what are they called? The president of Ryerson's making 300 grand a year. Or she. Redistribution of wealth.
But only the elected,
I support the students in this.
Well, I mean, most students don't want that Ryerson Student Union to be associated with the university anymore because they were using their money from their student fees on bottle service and
parties. Yeah, they abused.
Should have bottle service.
All students should have bottle service.
It wasn't all students, though.
If you fire the bureaucracy, then all students could afford bottle service.
I know that was vaguely
irrelevant.
Praxis.
Actually, the other kind of irrelevant thing that I wanted to bring up was, did you guys hear about like the scandals kind of related that have been going on in France? With like this guy Gabriel Metzniff, like this French literary figure, and he used to hang around with like Jean-Paul Sartre and Foucault and all those people, and and it just came out that he's been writing like openly about like his escapades, having sex with like 14-year-olds and like 8-year-old boys and stuff like that, and then finally like a book came out, and now the French literary press are like, you know, up in arms, and they're
writing openly.
Yeah, he was writing openly about it in like the 80s and 70s. There's like quotes from his book where he would like go to the Philippines, and he's like, "Oh, I'd have like exquisite lovemaking with like 8-year-old boys that he would have back," and the French intellectual class were just defending him. And in fact, Foucault and Sartre all like signed a petition to get rid of the age of consent in France.
Oh,
and like all these things, and like all
I did hear about this.
Oh. You did hear about this, yeah. And like all this stuff is, and there's a moment, and there's actually a really interesting moment when Gabriel Metzniff was like on some talk show, and there was also a French Canadian writer, I forget what her name is. I think her last name is Bombardier. And she was on the talk show talking about her book, and she was listening to this guy Metzniff talk about like how like, oh, he had a book called The Under 16s, which was like about like all the people.
This is a true story.
This has absolutely happened, and this is like so in the 80s. At this interview show on live TV,
that'd be nice. Everyone was like French too. The Soussais,
and he was talking about like on this day I'd be like hanging around with like Julien, and on this day I'd be with this woman, and he's like, and everyone's laughing, and then this French Canadian author,
La Fille Soussais, is that under 16?
And interrupts and says, I can't believe what I'm hearing right now. Like to the talk shows, she's like, if you were in my country, you'd be in jail right now. Like you're a pedophile. And then she got blacklisted from France, and like none of the publishers in France would see her. All this stuff's coming out. It's like France's Me Too movement.
That's horrible.
And like all the French intellectuals that we're talking about were defending this guy and seeing him as like an amazing literary figure, and like that the French, and it's kind of revealing that the French literary class kind of, they had their own set of rules, even though it's supposed to be like egalite, fraternity, and whatever. Well,
they
all that
liberated
stuff,
sexuality all, so much that they just saw no end to liberation of sexuality.
As they used to say, prohibit prohibition or something like that. I forgot what
too
it was.
Too much freedom is not.
I would just like to come out and say that the pill pod is an explicitly anti-pedophile podcast.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we can all agree on that.
What the fuck?
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that if you're going to write about having sex with underage children, it should be completely imaginary, like Lolita.
And try not to do that either.
Yeah, well, anyway, I don't know. Obviously, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it could be an interesting topic anyway, because it's like the hypocrisy of, I don't know, the French literary class with their own special rules.
Yeah, next podcast, Vladimir Nabokov.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm surprised you guys didn't. I mean, that's the interesting thing. Like, it didn't make the news at all. The only newspaper that covered it in English was the New York Times. Not a single other newspaper has been covering it.
Oh, I've never heard of that guy.
Really?
Is he well known? Really?
Probably. Apparently in France, he's like a literary juggernaut.
Fiction?
Yeah, fiction, nonfiction. I don't actually know. And he's hiding right now in the Italian Riviera. And like the police finally, they just filed charges on him like four days ago or 5 days ago.
Wow. They've got a lot of nuclear power plants over there. It's probably fucking with all their minds. They don't know what they're thinking. Chemtrails.
That must be
the they don't know what they're talking about.
The funniest detail is too in that interview when the French Canadian author like calls him out on it. He like responds like, "How dare you question me? Like I'm a writer, I'm a great writer." Like he literally fucking says that like back then. And everyone was like pretty much supporting him at the time. No one like everyone was like just looking the other way. Fuck.
And all those big thinkers were behind him?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, well, they all like co-signed that petition to get rid of the age of consent.
I bet Deleuze didn't.
Deleuze did, apparently.
Oh.
All of them did. They all hung around and protected each other, that like French literary class.
Well, my dissertation's going to take a hard right now.
No, I mean,
well, next week, we're going to bring to you Heidegger, the Nazi.
Try
to get over that.
I believe that right wingers never rape anybody or have sex with anyone underage.
None of these things make me not want to read these people. I mean,
especially Catholics. That stuff died out with the old feudalist political system.
Yeah, sorry, that was way off topic. But
45 minutes. So, outro. We just went.
I'm completely naked, by the way.
We just went on a long rabbit trail.
A rabbit trail. Is it a rabbit hole or is it a rabbit trail also?
Go back and forth.
It's a rabbit trail to the rabbit hole where we went deep.
Why don't you go bunk over there?
Go bunk and trickle.
I'm really interested. I'm going to hold you all accountable.
Anyways. Gotcha. Like the article, it seemed extremely prescient considering it was written 17 years ago.
Yeah, I like it.
Prescient.
Is it pronounced prescient or prescient? I like
that. I'm English. Either way, 8 out of 10, I'd say.
I'm going to keep it. You should just
prescient?
Keep
that pronunciation. I'd say Lay's chips, 8 out of 10. Prescient.
Oh, prescient.
Well, prescient.
Sienta is.
Presciento.
Is just before.
Sienta.
All right. We're just done here. All right. It seems that Latour was quite prophetic into issues that we face today that are mostly exacerbated by the internet. So I guess putting our neck out, as the case may be, is trying to establish matters of concern.
That's why we need us.
We have to establish how significant we are and how important this work is, because no one else is going to do it.
So is the PillPod here to think for our listeners?
Dare to use your reason, but
sapere aude, use our reason for you.
So you don't have to dare to use our reason instead.
Our trickle down reason. We're gonna trickle down. Please comment. I'm not sure you can tweet at us. I don't think any of us actually use Twitter. Doesn't mean you can't tweet at us.
Yeah.
I use Twitter, so find Matt McManus, and then find me in the comments underneath this tweet.
No, I think you should spam Matt McManus.
He's having a debate with Stefan Molyneux soon.
Oh, is that actually happening?
Yeah, Friday, 8 p.m.
It probably will have already happened by the time we...
Speaking of phrenology.
Friday, 8 p.m.
You had a debate, and apparently Stefan Molyneux killed him.
Follow my Instagram, too, while you're at it.
You haven't posted on Instagram in 2 years.
So?
All right. Thank you very much for listening, and we are signing off.